Hello, everyone, and such a warm welcome to you on this wintry day in Colorado where we're broadcasting from. It's a delight and honor to be hosting the guest presenter today, who happens to be Dr. Michael Gilbert from the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice, also known as the NACRJ. So welcome to you all. And of course, this is Molly Rowan Leach. Delighted to be your host. And this is a timely topic presentation special, exclusive, a very exclusive and special presentation, that is, for the Connection Series this month. So I wanted to do just some quick housekeeping before we drop in with Dr. Gilbert, and I'd also like to just share a little bit of background about him. First of all, we will be welcoming questions through the webcast today. So if you are not already on the webcast viewer, there are slides that Dr. Gilbert will be presenting. He will also, as you might see if you're on the webcast, be sharing with you two PDFs that you can easily click on and download. You'll see there's a button on the upper right-hand corner of your screen. It's turquoise, and it says Presentation PDF Handouts. So there's two of them. Feel free to click on those now if you'd like. It'll take you over to Restorative Justice on the Rise's back-end website just for participants today. So go ahead and check those out. He'll be referring to them during the presentation today as well. You'll also note, too, underneath that primary button, our call, it says Call Handouts and Links. These happen to be important links. One of them is for the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice 7th Conference, which is coming up in June this year in Denver, Colorado. And we're so looking forward to that event. It should be phenomenal. On the tails of the hugely attended and very well represented conference in Oakland, California in 2017. So if you're interested, we hope you would be in joining us there this June. Check out that link. Also, please, if you haven't already visited the Restorative Justice on the Rise podcasts, we are on iTunes. We feature dialogues from the last 8 years with global leaders in restorative justice and peace building. So we encourage you to utilize those resources, not just the podcast, but also a national map and other resources and media are there for you. You're also warmly welcomed to post your own organizational links there. So without further ado, I want to just honor Dr. Michael Gilbert. He is not only an incredibly astute retired professor of criminology and criminal justice, he is the executive director presently and since the founding in 2013 of the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice, which is, of course, also known as NACRJ. And it's just an incredible honor to have him here today to present on the topic of finding peace and building community, intersection between community and restorative justice. So that intersection is going to be explored very deeply today in how we find peace and build community together. And so just a great honor to have you here with us, Mike. I call you Dr. Gilbert, but I feel, you know, we can be a little less formal at this point and just welcome you into this virtual space with us. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this way. I'm thrilled to be here.
So just going into the slide presentation today, again, pointing your attention to the incredible PowerPoint that he's put together for us. If you're not already on the webcast, hop on there and get into that slide viewing pane. And at about 10 of the hour, we're going to take a brief intermission, but don't go away because we'll be coming back. We're just going to take a brief intermission for a few minutes at 10 till the hour. So that's coming up in, 40 minutes from now. So go ahead, Mike, and okay. Thank you again.
Well, thank you, Molly. It's such a pleasure to be here with you today. The presentation that I'm going to show you today is really the underpinnings and sort of the underlying logic for why the association NACRJ is the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice. And it oftentimes we get people who say, why isn't it just the National Association of Restorative Justice? And it's because of the underlying concepts that are so integrally tied together that people harm one another, and healing that harm between people and groups of people is necessary, but it's not sufficient to produce safe, just, equitable, and sustainable communities. You need to also address the other aspects of the lived experience in those communities, and that has to do with the social conditions. And community justice is really about addressing and ameliorating social conditions as much as you can so that they generate fewer harms inside those communities. So on the first slide, you'll see the dove. That is the logo for the National Association. And let me just tell you a little bit about that dove, because it symbolizes something that's pretty, I think, important from a restorative perspective, and that is that it represents well, obviously a dove, but doves will not attend to themselves and unless they feel safe and secure. And that is also true of individuals who are either victims of crime or offenders. And so part of the restorative process is to understand that it's relational at its heart, and that all parties have to feel reasonably safe and secure before they will do the deep work of repairing themselves and working to repair others. The multicolored plumage stands for human diversity in all its shapes and forms. And so we hope that this conveys sort of the underlying values that we have as an association, but also the underlying values that we should practice if we're going to live relationally in constructive ways with people in our society. So today, yes, we are going to focus on sort of the underlying logic, and it's the intersection between these two ideas. And I want to start out, as Molly said, I'm an old retired professor, and I spent 26 years teaching criminology, and I spent another 20-some-odd years working in the justice system in corrections. So all told, I have about 50 years working in this system, and along the way, I've developed a lot of ways of thinking about it that have helped me come to some conclusions about where we need to go. And this presentation is oriented toward helping us understand the basic arguments and direction for the future. So we start with this presentation looking back at the earliest ways of thinking about justice, and the Greeks really got on the board with trying to argue all a variety of different ways of thinking about justice. And they focused on things like mercy, equality, harmony, revenge, retaliation, and those were very early forms. Then you get into a later form of just deserts, and then you see, you know, sort of a fair and balanced exchange between people. And regardless of how you think about the term justice, the underlying framework is always balance and fairness as the underlying concept in any construction of what justice is. Now, we may have different sort of values and principles that are at play, but at the end of the day, it's still balance and fairness as the basic core ideas when we think about what justice is, what it means, and how we get it. So justice, then, is not primarily about punishment. Yet our criminal justice system and our traditional ways of thinking about justice is pretty much focused on punishment as the way of balancing the scales, if you will. But in reality, justice is mostly about fairness in repairing harms, promoting peaceful communities, and balancing the rights and interests of individuals and groups so that people can live together with respect and dignity and peace. And all of us have felt treated unjustly by someone who didn't violate a law, but certainly may have violated a norm that we found offensive, and yet no law was violated. And yet you can still feel victimized in that context. So justice then is relational, but it's also about how we deal with these conflicts. Now I want to present this slide. This slide is probably one of the most important pieces of this discussion because it goes directly to the structural inequality that is built in, it's baked in to our justice policy. And what you'll see is a grid, and the horizontal lines separate that grid into three spaces. There's the lower socioeconomic status, middle socioeconomic status, and upper socioeconomic status. And then there's a diagonal line going from the lower left to the upper right. And what that line represents is the split in our society between two forms of crime. One is street crime, and that is the crime that people commit, and it's usually crimes of, oftentimes it's crimes of people of poverty or people of limited means or living in disenfranchised ways in neighborhoods with multiple deprivations. And we see that on that side of the diagonal, okay, we see that street crimes are mostly focused in terms of the quantitative numbers, mostly among lower socioeconomic status, and then there's a smaller amount that's in the middle socioeconomic status and a much smaller amount in the upper socioeconomic status. But what I want you to understand is that street crime is the least committed crime in our society, form of crime, and it produces less harm than white-collar and corporate crime. White-collar and corporate crime is the other side of that diagram, and that what you see are the harms committed by people in power with influence, with money, who use that power, influence, and money to often extract value, but it can lead to deaths as well. In fact, if you do any reading of the literature on white-collar crime, you will find that white-collar crime accounts for probably 10 to 20 times the number of people who are injured and killed every year compared to street crime. And it by far takes far more value out of your pocket than street crime does, okay? Yet it's the street criminal who will end up in prison, but the white-collar criminal who will not end up in prison. In fact, the white-collar criminal will often be treated as a civil offender, and they will go to civil court, and they will get a fine, but they will not go to prison. But if some kid goes in and holds up a store with a banana in his pocket, he is likely to find himself on the south side of the law and be doing prison time. So this structural inequality is structured right into our law so that when we look at criminal offenses, they are defined almost exclusively in terms of street crime. And that shifts the lens and shifts the focus of our attention away from the most prevalent forms of crime and the most serious forms of crime, which are white-collar and corporate crime. And so we end up with our prisons filled with people coming from neighborhoods that are highly impoverished and generally composed of people of color. And this structural inequality is at the heart of our society. It's been built into our laws. And in fact, if you ask who creates the laws, it's the people who have interests in white-collar and corporate crime that are often sitting at the same table creating the laws. And so they don't declare what they do criminal, they declare what other people do criminal. And so we end up with this very biased system. And it is, as I say, right at the heart of our justice system as it is today. Now, There have been many ways of achieving justice throughout history. The earliest ways were when we had no social structure at all, really, to speak of, and if you were harmed, you had to attain justice privately. And so you had to gain revenge, if you will, for someone who harmed you. A great study, if you will, on sort of the private justice approach is to look at any story or program that presents sort of the medieval times of justice. I mean, it was literally people taking justice into their own hands. And then as time went on, we began to realize that that creates revenge cycles, and so we began to moderate the ways we thought about what justice meant and how we attained it. And so we see a change through time going from private justice to balancing harms, which meant that you could do no more to the person who harmed you than he or she did to you. That's where the notion of an eye for an eye comes in. Before that, under private justice, it was whatever you felt made you whole again as the victim, you could do to the offender. And then you have other approaches, morality versus sin, which is oriented toward various faith systems, understandings of equality and fairness, and social justice, legal justice. And then you get down to things like restorative justice and community justice. And these are the relational models of justice that we see today that are very likely to be effective in addressing harms between people by engaging those affected in some sort of a dialogue to find healing and accountability and make amends and reintegration back into community. Both the victims need reintegration, but also the offenders need reintegration. And then community justice, which is about understanding the quality of life in geographical areas and neighborhoods, and trying to do something meaningful with community, not to community, to improve that quality of life. I would wager that most of you listening on this call today live in a community in which there are neighborhoods that you know of as high crime, and they've been high crime for probably 100 years. Here in San Antonio, I know exactly where those neighborhoods are, and they have, in fact, been high crime for 100 years. And what they all have in common is that they all are neighborhoods of multiple deprivation, and they have very geographically defined spaces. Now, our traditional system is adversarial, and this slide really is a schematic that comes from Van Essen-Strong. What it shows is that the traditional system has the government lining up, if you will, people from the community and the victim and the offender, but they are basically material witnesses to a process that is conducted by the prosecutor and the defense attorney. And the defense attorney is looking for fairness, and the prosecutor is looking for public order, if you will. And the approach that is taken to attain justice is retribution. Retribution means that if you commit a certain kind of offense, rather than a similar offense being committed against you, you might be, say, you committed a robbery, but you might receive retribution in the form of a prison sentence of 3 to 5 years. So it's a suitable punishment, but not necessarily a like punishment that would fit the harm that was done. Now, if we look at punishment-oriented justice in the United States, there's something that stands out. There are some things that stand out as strikingly odd with the picture that we seem to be told all the time that if we take a punitive approach that'll have positive salient benefits socially. And what we find in the United States is, for example, we have only 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prisoners. And that has been pretty static for a while. This particular data was found in 2008, but also you can also find it documented as recently as 2018. And what this suggests is that the United States is either terribly criminogenic for people, or we're doing something terribly wrong in our society. there's no way that we should, with 5% of the world's population, have 25% of the world's prisoners. And then we have roughly 2.2 million people in prison or jail. And when we look at those incarceration numbers, the next two nations that are big nations that are close to us are Russia and China. And quite simply, if you're following the deterrence argument, if toughness and punishment work, then the United States should have the lowest street crime rates in the world. And on top of that, if you look at your neighborhoods in your community and you go and ask, well, what neighborhoods have the most or the highest percentage of people who have been punished by the law? That is, they carry a criminal conviction and they've been perhaps to jail and prison or under probation supervision. And what you will find is that they almost always come from the neighborhoods with the highest crime rates. And so one would think that the neighborhoods with the most punished people would also be the safest neighborhoods. But unfortunately, they're not. Now, this slide is just looking at the number of people confined in the United States and comparing them either by rate or by number. On the left-hand side, the slide shows that the two big dogs, both in 2008 and 2017, by number of people confined, were the United States and China. And so what's remarkable about thinking about this is that the United States has one-fifth the population of China. So if you think about that for a second, what that suggests is that the United States is incarcerating at a much higher rate per 100,000 than China is. And yet China is viewed as a totalitarian state. And so that really kind of changes the lens through which you view what we're doing. If on the other side, you see the incarceration rate, and in 2008, China drops completely off the grid here, and it's the top two in 2008 were U.S. and Russia. In 2017, Russia's incarceration rate actually dropped substantially, and they slid down this table to probably about 15th or 20th down on that table. But China is completely off the grid. I mean, completely off. And what that is saying is that because their incarceration rate, having five times the population of the United States, is so low, it doesn't even get on the top 25 nations in terms of the rate of incarceration. These kinds of comparisons begin to suggest that there's something wrong going on, okay? And yet in 2018, we have had some declines in the use of incarceration, but not very much, and we still lead both in terms of number and rate. Now, as a criminologist, I've been asked many times what drives prison population, and most people expect me to say, well, it's crime, but it's not. Crime is independent of the prison population. What drives the prison population are two policy-driven factors. That is, the number of offenders who are sentenced to prison or jail and the number who are returned to incarceration for revocation or for additional crimes. And the second factor is the time served. That is, the length of the sentence that they are given. Now, both of these factors are controlled by lawmakers, and they are not controlled by crime. And those lawmakers have been trapped for 50 years in the rhetoric of tough on crime, and so we've had a ratcheting effect for well over 50 years that has ramped up the severity of our sentences on the premise that it will drive down crime rates. And what we find is that crime rates and these kinds of sentences are generally independent. They have little or no relationship to one another. And so what's really causing our incarceration boom is not crime. It is our policy response toward crime. So when we look at the impacts of traditional legal justice systems, what we find, and you know, this is pretty obvious to anybody who has been looking at this, is that there's a disproportionate impact on our criminal by our criminal justice system by race, ethnicity, and class. And of course, this is directly related to that structural inequality that's baked into the justice system that I showed you earlier on that table where we looked at white collar crime versus street crime. And what we often fail to recognize is that the justice system in the United States has been created over many years by often well-intended people, but it doesn't question the structural inequalities in our system, and it doesn't see the injustices that are perpetuated by the system that is so skewed with a structural inequality right at its heart. And so we see the perpetuation of historical harm and injustice, particularly in communities of color. And we're just now becoming sort of really attuned to this issue, and we're seeing efforts on both sides of the political aisle to have justice systems changes so that we can ameliorate some of those harms that are there. And on top of that, you have huge direct and indirect fiscal and social costs. The social costs far exceed the direct fiscal costs. And the traditional legal system is supposed to be an effective approach to producing safe, just, equitable, and sustainable communities. But what we see over and over and over again is that it simply does not live up to that billing, and is oftentimes, instead of justice, it's injustice. And I'm an old criminal justice professor who worked for 50 years in and around the justice system, and I want justice systems to work. I want them to work well. I want them to respect human dignity. I want them to respect diversity. I want them to work in a way that is meaningful and effective when it comes to changing the quality of life and changing, sort of the dynamics around harm to people by other people. But what we find is that there's very little evidence of that actually occurring. Now, traditional legal systems fail on a lot of levels, but one of the ones that is most problematic is that they fail to distinguish between crime and criminals. Criminals are people who harm one another or commit violations of law. But you can arrest criminals all day long, 7 days a week. You can lock them up, and the crime will stay. So think about a kid dealing drugs on a street corner. Most people would say, well, arrest that kid, lock him up. So we arrest that kid, and we do lock him up, and we give him sort of a life-altering sentence that makes him an ex-offender. But how long will it be before the next kid shows up at that street corner? And let's arrest that one. And let's say we keep doing this ad infinitum. We have arrested every kid who shows up to that street corner. Now, eventually, somebody's going to say there's something odd about that street corner. Let's go sell somewhere else. But the idea is that there's always replacement. And since there's always replacement, what you find is the crime stays, regardless of what you do with the criminals. And this is why neighborhoods in my town and probably your town are also high crime areas, despite having a large proportion of the people from that neighborhood locked up. Because the criminals go away, the crime stays. They are not the same. Now, we also assume public safety depends on enforcement, but this does not recognize the role of replacement, which I just mentioned. It also does not recognize the criminogenic influences that occur with adverse social conditions in neighborhoods. That is, antisocial conditions generally increase criminality, and pro-social conditions decrease it. So neighborhoods that have well-organized neighborhoods that oftentimes have sort of the good, what we would perceive as good neighborhoods, they generally will have fairly low street crime. They might have some white-collar crime operating in those neighborhoods, but as we said, that's treated very differently. The justice system tends to ignore the evidence, okay? And by that, what I mean is we've been studying crime for a lot of years, and what we find is that high crime areas remain unchanged for decades despite the intensive enforcement efforts. So we end up with evidence that says, you know what, whatever you're doing, it isn't really deterring people committing crime, and on top of that, it isn't changing our communities in a way that is, particularly our high crime communities, in a way that leads to safe, just, equitable, and sustainable communities. So this over-reliance really forces us to reactively remove criminals, but it simply doesn't do much to reduce crime. So in the process, what we don't do is we don't heal the harms to people, and we don't focus our energies on doing something about the kinds of conditions that exist in high crime neighborhoods. So we simply fail on all of those levels when we focus so heavily on enforcement. So it's becoming increasingly clear that the roots of street crime are really linked to the adverse social conditions that we see, and that jurisdictions are not going to be able to deal with street crime by relying so heavily on traditional enforcement. What we are going to do, though, is what we need is to focus more on prevention. And that we know from studies that just about every dollar you put into prevention has a $6 return in terms of benefit to society, whereas the same dollar you put into criminal justice systems probably doesn't produce a benefit. It produces oftentimes negative value. Yet we do need both. We need prevention, which will address the problems in neighborhoods and help heal harms. But we also need enforcement, because there are people who, for whatever reason, they will not control themselves, and we do need to protect the public from those kinds of people and those kinds of systems that are, I mean, those kinds of conditions. What we also need is to see the traditional legal system become the option of last resort. That is, it's still there. It's still available to us should we need it, but it is not our first go-to response. There are now probably 27 or 30 nations out there where they're trying to make this transition, and they have systematically, in fact, all EU nations combined, require that you have restorative processes in your legal systems approach for criminal justice, and they are trying to encourage broader application of these ideas rather than reliance on traditional justice systems, even though they still exist. And that would mean that relational justice approaches become options of first choice rather than you know, sort of marginalized and last option. If we can make this policy shift where traditional legal justice systems are there, but they're used as a last resort when other relational approaches have failed, then we, I think, are moving in a constructive direction. So when we look at crime prevention policies, what we find very clearly, and there's quite a bit of research that's out there, and it's mounting all the time, that these approaches are more effective, they are less expensive, they are socially constructive, and they are sustainable. And when we look at the options available, they focus on community justice and they focus on restorative justice as the primary modes of prevention policies that are likely to be effective today, okay, and probably for the future. So community justice looks at ideas like community development, engaging the residents in a co-equal relationship to figure out what change might look like in their neighborhood. There's a focus on redeveloping pro-social norms as people work together to address problems. And there's an effort to create safe, just, equitable, and livable and sustainable communities and neighborhoods. But it's not an effort that's done from the outside. It's an effort that's done from the inside by residents and people there that are living there. But they do it with support and assistance and some facilitation of the justice system, of the social services that are available to our communities, the legal system, and so the role of traditional legal justice, if you will, shifts from one in which they're going to react to the problem to one in which they're going to facilitate change within these communities. And of course, we have restorative justice, which is repairing harms between people. Now, restorative justice is necessary, but it's not sufficient to do the job. We need both. And that is, we got to walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to address the conditions within which people live, as well as helping to find ways to repair harm that has occurred. Now, to do this, it will require a change in justice philosophy and law. It will mean that we have to become less focused on punitive reaction to offenders, and we have to become more focused on a balanced approach where prevention policies are central and are first in line for the response to the problem. So legal systems then simply do not work as advertised. And we must, if you will, do more than arrest, convict, and punish. We have to prevent and repair. And prevent and repair means that we have to focus on relational forms of justice like community justice and restorative justice. So these are the two sort of forms of justice that we see today that are likely to ensure that we can heal or at least approach healing harms, you know, hold offenders accountable, prevent crime through the creation of peaceful and more livable communities. So people say, well, you know, you don't want to conflate restorative justice and community justice, and I just fundamentally disagree with that point of view. Yeah, you know, if you're scientifically a purist and you're trying to look at the effects of one versus the other, you probably have to keep them separated. But if you try to keep them separated in terms of policy implementation, in terms of practice, you're going to lose your best chance of producing safe, just, and livable communities because they share tremendous number of values and principles. And on this slide, under the left side, there's a listing of values that are commonly associated with both community justice and restorative justice. And there, on the right side, there are principles that are commonly associated with both. And if you look down that list, these are at the heart of what relational justice is. Relational justice is the overarching concept that embraces both community justice and restorative justice. They both are dialogic. They both focus on human relationships between people and groups of people. They both focus on addressing harms. It's just that the harms at the community level are often the result of structural decisions that are in our society that have downstream of impacts that appear and show up in communities where there's very little social capital in those communities. So these are the high crime neighborhoods that have been there for 100 years. And if you look at the impacts of our policies for over that period of time and before, you'll find that policies decided in the 1800s still have ripple effects today in our communities. Classic example of this is our drug laws. You know, humans have used mood-altering drugs for thousands of years. And there's no linkage to crime between mood-altering drugs and human behavior for probably almost all of that time. It's only in 1875 when we see that mood-altering drugs begin to be linked to crime, and they begin to be linked to crime by a fellow by the name of Samuel Gompers, who was a labor organizer in San Francisco at the time when there was a recession there, and all of the Chinese laborers who were coming back from the railroads that had been completed and the mines that had been completed were ending up in San Francisco, and they were seen as a threat to working white people, quite frankly. And so he pushed to change laws in San Francisco that would make it impossible for Chinese laborers to be competitive against white laborers. And so they passed the Tax Act in San Francisco, which then made smoking opium illegal and criminal, and they began to frame the users of smokable opium in terms of violence toward women and children. It is only then that we see this linkage between the substance use and criminal behavior, but it's policy-driven linkage. It is not driven by actual crime. And it was driven to serve a political purpose. So we have to see that, you know, the impacts of those policies that went from 1875 all the way through to, you know, the Rockefeller Acts and many others were all based on race, power, money, influence, control, marginalization of certain groups of people for the benefit of others. That all occurred and has an impact today when we see the incarceration rates and we see the poverty in our communities that are high crime today. And that's just one example, and there are many, many, many examples of these kinds of things. So when we begin to talk about how do we address these impacts, well, first thing, I look at these common values and principles, and I understand that when you line up community justice and restorative justice, they are operating on the same wavelength. They're not the same identically, but they operate on the same wavelength, and they approach the problems in often similar matters, but they are focusing their attempt to address harm. Restorative justice is mostly between people and perhaps, you know, as groups of people, but community justice is looking at how do we heal harms that are often structurally rooted in our society, and how do we find a way to ameliorate those conditions in neighborhoods. So the restorative and community justice strategies that are most common are family group conferencing, victim-offender dialogue, which tends to mean, when we use that terminology, tends to mean victim-offender dialogue in prisons, because we have a facilitated process where victims want to talk to offenders, and if the prison system will support that, then we often refer to that as victim-offender dialogue. There is one that I left out here. It's victim-offender mediation, which is usually referring to dialogic processes between victims and offenders that are in the community and are often, if they're tied to the criminal justice system, they're often as a diversion from traditional criminal justice processing. And then, of course, you have various forms of circle processes. If you look at Kay Prentice's Circle Keeper Handbook, you'll see a lot of different ways circles can be done. And then community safety boards that are often responding to harm, but they doing and crime, but doing it in a dialogic way. There are many ways to approach these ideas. We see restorative practices now being widely practiced in schools. In fact, at the next conference, and even at the last conference, 70% of our attendees were educators. Because they find that these ideas, when they're integrated with, you know, PBIS systems that they have in schools, and when they're used to augment community building, that they can have a strong effect on behavior in schools. And then, of course, you got community justice approaches such as Neighborhood Watch, Cellular on Patrol, community courts, teen courts, community circles and councils and things like that, and then neighborhood-based organizations and associations that are working to change conditions. Oftentimes, these use circle processes as a way of providing a sort of dialogic approach to understanding what needs to be done in a particular community and how best to go about attaining that. So these are two sides of the same coin. And there is, I meant to refer to the handout, there is a handout that is on the basic principles of restorative and community justice, and it compares these two systems. I would recommend that you download that handout. It is also available on the NACRJ website, but I would recommend that you download that and keep it because it gives you a handy, easy way of understanding the linkages between community justice and restorative justice. And quite simply, they're two sides of the same coin. One focuses on repairing harms to people, and the other one focuses on improving quality of life in neighborhoods. And some examples of where these kinds of things can be used are things like prior to conviction. This is where you have perhaps a diversion approach from prosecution. They can be used after conviction as a way of getting at sentencing, if you will. They can be used after conviction, but they would have maybe perhaps no effect on sentencing, but offenders perhaps want to make amends, and victims have questions that they want to ask, and if there's an amenable way of getting them together that's facilitated and mediated, it can have a profound impact on helping victims come to terms with what's happened to them and find peace because they get their questions answered. It can be used in reentry preparation with offenders. I've seen this happen quite a few times here in San Antonio, where we were doing reentry circles in prison, helping people who are going to get released probably within the next 6 months to a year to begin to process sort of what's happened in their lives and how they are going to proceed from that point on. But in those circles, you have representatives from the communities in which they are going to come back to. And it was not unusual to see people from the prison coming in to those meetings the very first times, and they carry the baggage of personal behaviors that work in jail and work in prisons, sort of swaggering and a demeanor that is very classic that you see oftentimes with offenders when they're incarcerated. And they come into circle like that at first, but then gradually over time as the circles progress, the facade of the inmate fades away, and then all of a sudden you see the real person, and it's Ted, it's Bob, it's Jane, and they are the real person who is still inside that facade, but they haven't allowed themselves to express who they are. And in those circles, they begin to encounter people who are seeing them now. They're going to come back to their neighborhood, and they have some anxieties and fears about that. But pretty soon they begin to learn each other as a person. They begin to demystify who they are and what they're about. And in that transition, it's not unusual to see offenders, express deep, deep, deep remorse for what they have done to others, to their children, to the women that they've had those children with, to express deep remorse for how they have, basically screwed up their lives, and to build relationships with the community members who are participating in that circle. And I've seen a case where one young man who'd been in prison quite a bit and was now in this program or in this approach, and he let himself, put it this way. He was expressing how he had come to realize through these circles, even though that they made him feel very bad about himself at times, because he realized the depth of harm that he had done to himself and to his family, to his kids, to the women that he had had those kids with, and he found himself at night sometimes under the sheet crying. And when he expressed that in the circle, we saw people in the circle, other offenders who were there and other members of the community, provide emotional support for him in that growth of being able to express that. And one of the women in the circle lives in the community which he was going to go back to, because she knows exactly where he's going to live, okay? And she says to him, when you first came in, I was a bit afraid of you that first night, and since then I've seen you differently. At first I saw just a young thug, a punk, somebody who I would be afraid to have come back in my neighborhood. But as we've spent time together, I see you, and I see you owning up to the harms that you have done. And I see a man now, not a young punk or a thug. I see a man now rising before my eyes. And I think I could say to you now, welcome home. I want to see you in my neighborhood. And I will help you get your life back together. The young man just burst out bawling. And he admitted that all the times he had been locked up, he had never let anybody see him cry. And this was the first time. He thought that he had ruined his relationships with the community and with people so badly that he would never hear "Welcome Home." And yet he heard it that night. That's an example of a relational form of justice in action in a reentry process. And it's real. That one I was in because I was leading the circle. It was just amazing.
Wow. That's powerful, Mike. Thank you so much. I just want to gently interject here right now that we're just about at intermission point. Please don't go away. We're just going to take a brief intermission. Is this a good time to stop for a moment?
Yeah, yes, it would be.
Okay, wonderful. Well, to everyone gathered right now, Dr. Gilbert will be right back. And if you would like to take a pause yourself, a bio break of any kind, get some tea or water, whatever it is that you need, or stay with me, I'm going to be sharing just a little bit about the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice, just a little bit about the upcoming conference as well. Again, welcome. If you're joining us late, we are in the middle of a timely topic presentation with Dr. Michael Gilbert, Finding Peace, Building Community, the Intersection of Community and Restorative Justice. And just a reminder also that you are warmly welcome to use the Q&A tab on the webcast page to submit your questions. We're going to go into those when he returns here briefly to his presentation. So in order to find that Q&A tab, simply look to the right-hand portion of your webcast screen, and you'll see a live chat and a Q&A tab there where you can enter your question or comment. And we really appreciate your participation and welcome it. So for those of you that aren't aware of the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice, there's a bit of history to it that's very interesting, and I thought I'd share just briefly about that history and then about the upcoming conference that is in Denver, Colorado in June. So on June 19th of 2013, the NACRJ was publicly presented to the attendees at the 4th National Conference on Restorative Justice, and that was hosted by the University of Toledo and the Lourdes University in Toledo, Ohio. The National Association of Community and Restorative Justice was created to serve as the parent organization for the biannual National Conference on Restorative Justice. Three prior conferences had been conducted, and those were in 2007 in Texas, in 2009 in San Antonio at the University of Texas, and 2011 at Campbell University. And of course, there have been conferences since then, every 2 years. And those early conferences, though, were planned and organized primarily by a local organizing committee with a lead organizer, with support and assistance from the National Organizing Committee, composed of prior conference organizers and prominent academics and practitioners. And that model continues to this day. There is a local organizing committee in Colorado that works directly with the National Organizing Committee. That includes Dr. Gilbert. So the original idea, just a little bit about the original idea to form the NACRJ came forward during the 3rd National Conference on Restorative Justice in Raleigh, North Carolina. And members of the national and local organizing committees met over dinner to discuss how to provide a legal home for the national conference. The time had come to think about institutionalizing the biannual conferences that were successfully conducted, and then some, since 2007. And so it was decided that they would form a new national association rather than affiliate or join with an existing one. And of course, as Dr. Gilbert explained, at the time he was with the Department of Criminal Justice at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and he became the lead organizer for the 2009 National Conference. He also recruited three other people to be integral partners in organizing the board of directors and to serve as the organizing board of directors, that is. And that's Dr. Fania Davis, of course, from previously the executive director from Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, Professor John Powell with the Norman Adrian Wiggins School of Law at Campbell University, and then Professor Joanne Katz, the Department of Criminal Justice at Missouri Western State University. And so that's a little bit of a foundation and details about the association's founding. Of course, Dr. Gilbert has been covering the guiding principles around values and principles around the centerpiece of the intersection of community and restorative justice, and how critical those are to the association. And per their name as well, the name of association. So just Mike, if you're back with us, I just want to say a few more words about the conference.
Yeah, sure.
And then we'll bring you back in. Sure. So as I've shared, the NACRJ is a major sponsor of the Connection Series, for which Restorative Justice on the Rise is deeply grateful for that support. We believe this series to be incredibly integral to providing practices, solutions, and connectivity for people on the ground doing this work. So we're really grateful to the NACRJ for that belief in this work and the support. Please join the NACRJ as they host the 7th National Conference. And again, that's June 14th through the 16th, 2019, with a pre-conference training day on June 13th at the Sheraton Hotel in downtown Denver, which is about 2.5 hours north of where we are right at this moment. It's a beautiful place, the Sheraton. It's a great place to be right in the heart of Denver. And those pre-conference trainings are going to be a wonderful array of selections, including Healing Historical Harm, Rocks, Karma, Arrows with, let's see,
it's being run by Modus Group.
Okay, great. That's by the Modus Theater. And then the afternoon session will be Trauma-Informed Restorative Practices, Considerations for RJ Programs and Practitioners, along with some youth-led workshop possibilities for you and an open space session. And then into the main conference, a wonderful keynote from Senator Pete Lee at this point, who was integral in Colorado's implementation of legislative law and practice of restorative justice. So really going to be a great lineup. I think that's all I'm going to say right now, but you can see that there's a link directly to more information about the conference, about the NACRJ on the webcast page. So thank you, Mike, so much for being with us and back into the presentation. And
okay.
If you'd like to take some questions in a little bit, we can do that as well.
Yeah,
and
well,
remember,
if there are questions now up to this point, maybe this would be a good time to take one or two of them.
Okay. I have one from Robert. And he asks, what are your thoughts on the prison industrial complex? Is it a primary factor in the horrific state of mass incarceration? Thank you for that question.
The prison industrial complex basically is all the industries around incarceration that make profit out of human incarceration. And their business model is one that is rooted directly in maintaining high levels of incarceration, and when they're publicly traded with stock, they have forecasts for how they're going to maintain their revenue stream. And when they talk about this, it's as if they're talking about producing some some tangible product, material product, but what they are talking about is human beings. And I find it quite objectionable to think in these ways, and they advocate for policies that will be more punitive rather than less punitive. They will advocate for policies that have stronger sentencing behind them, longer terms, things like that. They will want to incarcerate more, not incarcerate, they will want to criminalize more things rather than less things. So their policy agenda is directly in opposition to the efforts to try to reduce our incarceration rates. Okay, so they operate in direct opposition to it, and this is one of the reasons why, I mean, I'll share with you, NACRJ will not accept donations or support from the private prison industry. Okay. So we have made that as a policy decision internally. We need the money, but we're not going to take it from groups that are antithetical to the mission, vision, values, and principles of the association.
Thank you, Mike. And also, Mike, thank you for your volunteer work, tireless efforts with the association. You'll see Mike at conferences, at registration, and behind the scenes, and doing a lot of different aspects of organizing with the local teams. So just want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
I meant to acknowledge that the NACRJ is a volunteer-run organization.
Yeah, a lot of people think that even though we know what we're doing when it comes to running conferences, we've learned a lot, and we run very, very good conferences. But we are, at its heart, we're an all-volunteer, 501c3 nonprofit, and running a conference that is $500,000 in terms of budgeted costs is a financially frightening leap of faith every time we do it, because we really don't know if we're going to end up being able to pull it off financially. We got a pretty good idea that it's going to be okay, but we don't know until the end. And we hope that you all can see the value in what we do, and that you will either join the association or that you will attend the conference.
How about both?
How about both? I like both.
Yeah, how about both? And also, please know, if you haven't been to an NACRJ conference, they are so well represented, cultural diversity, LGBTQ, very inclusive, and very well represented with voices from, a lot of different cultural heritages, which is really important. And that's what I appreciate about the conferences, besides the fact that they're run so well. So we have another question, Mike, and it comes from Lily. Thank you, Lily, for this question. And she asks, can restorative justice be used with adults and also with violent offenses? Do you have any examples of successes?
Well, yeah, the answer to that is yes. I mean, it will be used differently in different circumstances, okay? What you have to understand is that restorative practices is about healing harms between people and groups of people, and sometimes that means harm that is the result of a homicide or a violent crime, okay? When you think about eligibility for restorative practice, if there is a violent crime involved, they're almost certainly not going to be provided an opportunity to do this as a diversion from traditional justice. It'll be following the traditional legal justice, and it will then be a part of sentencing. It might be a part of programming while they're incarcerated or ready for release. But there's a lot of incidences, where victim-initiated restorative practices for violent crime have occurred, and that is the victims of the crime seek out an opportunity to have dialogue with the offender, and it's about finding answers to their questions and providing an opportunity for healing that could be helped by a dialogue with the offender. And these have occurred, and they have been quite successful on a case-by-case basis. But most of the success depends on preparation. You cannot do these things without extensive preparation of both the victim and the offender, because what they cannot do is they cannot demean each other in that dialogue. They have to be able to tell their stories and provide their answers in a way that preserves the dignity and safety of the other individual in the dialogue. And that takes preparation. So if you remember the preening dove, which is in the upper left-hand corner, in order to do the self-work that is necessary for both victims and offenders to find a way of understanding what justice might mean for them, they both have to feel safe and secure in that dialogue. And that doesn't happen unless there's preparation in advance to do that. So it can occur and does occur, but it probably won't occur as a diversion from traditional legal processes. There's almost no prosecutor that's going to do that, okay? And there's probably no judge that's going to do that. I hope that helps. By the way, restorative processes have been used in many, many countries to heal historical harms and very, very violent harms, such as the apartheid violence in South Africa. Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa is a classic example of what can happen when dialogic approaches are taken to rebuild relationships and address the harms that have occurred. And South Africa could have had an internal civil war that was, black Africans against white Afrikaans, and that could have happened but did not happen. And it did not happen because of the wisdom of Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela, and the prime minister at the time, which I think was Prime Minister Botha. And they realized that in order for their nation not to go through that kind of a process, there had to be some healing, and they approached it from a truth and reconciliation approach, which is a restorative justice model for dealing with huge societal harm.
Thank you. Just quickly, in addition to Robert's question came in, but I don't have a name tagged to the question, but thank you. Relating to the privatization of the criminal justice system, also known as the prison industrial complex. This person is curious to know, what are your ideas for bringing attention to it and moving away from it? So if you would add to that and go back to that for a moment, Mike, and then we can dive back into the presentation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I think right now there's a lot of efforts that are going on to try to reduce the proportionality of and disproportional uses of justice systems and to understand and sort of counter the effect of the private prison and prison industrial complex. Some of those are led by Van Jones, I believe, and the young man who just created the new memorial in Montgomery to the lynched African American.
Brian Stevenson.
I'm trying to remember his name, but I can't remember his name right now.
Brian Stevenson.
Brian
and Van Jones.
Okay.
50. Yeah.
So there's I think the movement is called Cut by 50, okay, and what that is that's an effort to say to people in our society and policymakers, we need policies that will result in reducing incarceration by 50% within the next decade, and the trajectory is going down, but it's going down slowly, and in recent years, prison populations have gone down, but jail populations have gone up. So it's not a uniform decline. But it's going to happen because, quite frankly, the justice system, the way it's conceptualized, is unsustainable economically, socially, and even politically. And we're getting to that point where we're understanding there's something terribly wrong with what we're doing, and quite frankly, I deal with justice system officials all the time. I don't know of one thoughtful justice system official that won't admit that. And so I think change is coming, and I think it is inevitable, because when you look at the comparison between traditional justice systems and relational justice systems, the traditional approach, hugely expensive, ineffective, often socially destructive, and perhaps even injustice to begin with. And then you look at relational justice systems, they tend to work. They don't work perfectly, but they tend to work. They don't cost a lot. They're not socially destructive, and they don't have any real serious downsides that are social, you know, adverse social impacts. So I think the odds are on the side of relational justice becoming the dominant model for perhaps the next 100 years or more.
Great, and great questions. Thank you for those submissions. I'll go ahead and hand it back over to you, Mike, to proceed with the presentation. And just if you're in a time-sensitive spot, we'll probably be going for another 20 minutes. Is that about right, Mike?
I think about that, okay?
Yep, okay, great.
Okay.
Thank you.
I will left off with the story about the reentry programming using a restorative practice here in San Antonio. But then the next one down is post-release, which is looking to take reentry processes and use them in a relational way to reconnect offenders who are coming out of prisons to community instead of isolating, marginalizing, and excluding formerly incarcerated people. We're talking about engaging and involvement and getting them linked into the community. And if you think about social control, informal social control only works when there's a relationship. And if you have a system that totally isolates, marginalizes, and excludes, that's a prescription for more offending. That's an increase in crime, not a decrease in crime. So the way you get to a decrease in crime with a reentry population is to engage with them, help them, work with them, develop a structured process where they can become part of a community. And then we see community circles, which are evident in a lot of places, that can be used to focus on the kinds of harms that are in the community itself and what can be done about them. And that process develops two things. It, one, builds social control, but it also builds social capital and collective efficacy, which are two terms. The first one, that social capital, means that people get together and they have influence and they're able to access resources in the community. The collective efficacy means that people feed into the behavior of one another, and it's part of social control, but what it means that it's pro-social, and people in the community are able to exert influence on the behaviors of others. And then, of course, we've seen a huge increase of school-based applications of restorative practices. And the reason why there's such a huge interest in schools is because it tends to work. And it can be quite effective in managing behavior within schools and make so that kids can feel safe and focus on their studies. One of the things that has been interesting to me is to watch the expansion in schools, and I began to rethink sort of my initial thinking was that these ideas would spread from justice systems out into the community. I now think that's wrong. I think they're spreading out into the community, and they'll come back to justice systems. And I think what's going to happen is kids are going to come home to their parents who are working in the justice system talking about how they handle conflict in schools, and they're going to tell these stories, and their parents are going to get hit with, hey, mom and dad, why don't you do some of that with what you do? I think it's going to come back that way. Now, on the next slide, there's just as a family group conferencing. It refers to the handout, a burglary, an old man, and finding justice. And this is a true story, but it was conveyed to me in a training session when I first started getting into restorative practices back in 2001. And I think it's worth a read, because it's an easy way for people to sort of grasp how justice can be found in a dialogic, relational way. And I offer that to you as a way of helping you sort of get your head around how this can work. And it's a wonderful story, it really is. And I won't tell this story here because we just don't have time. But you can read it, and it's a really wonderful story.
Mike, sorry to interject, but for those coming in later and didn't hear, there is a link directly on the webcast to those two PDFs. I just wanted to remind people of that. Thank you.
And then, of course, you have community circles. An example of this is the Safe Streets Milwaukee Project. It's a reentry program in which they are working with returning offenders who want to rebuild their relationship and make amends to their community. They're called the Red Coats, and they wear a red coat, just a regular sort of a red jacket that they wear around. But they're recognizable, and they have chosen to deliberately go around the neighborhood and be of assistance to people. They will take people's prescriptions and go to the grocery store or go to the pharmacy and pick them up. They will help the people who are housebound with grocery shopping. And basically what they're doing is earning redemption back into the community. And as one of the Redcoats said very publicly, that this particular neighborhood is one that he had victimized and people feared him. Now he feels that people respect him and he's welcome. And he said he wouldn't trade that for anything. So here we are, you know, in short, reducing recidivism through social inclusion, not isolation, not marginalization, through support and accountability where they have the ability to be accountable to one another, but also to the community, and then linking them back into the community. This is a relational approach, and it is clearly a community justice-oriented approach. And then there are community circles like the one that I conducted in Lincoln Courts here in San Antonio. This was a project that started in 2008 and went through about 2010. And since then, they have continued it on their own, having community circles in Lincoln Courts. Now, Lincoln Courts is a public housing area, and the community circle is designed to build relationships between people because oftentimes, even though people live close together in public housing projects, they often don't know their neighbors very well, and they often keep to themselves. In part, it's out of fear of the other residents that are there because, you know, there's a lot of incivilities that occur. You know, clothes get stolen off of clotheslines, and there's open-air use of drugs that are in the neighborhood and right nearby. And there's a lot of things that make they're good families living in a bad place. They have good kids. They're trying to raise good kids, but they're afraid of what the environment is outside the door. Okay, so the first thing to try to do is to build those social relationships between people, and then you're trying to figure out how can you help them or how work with them to strengthen their ability to change the conditions that are there. So we began to work with them in a variety of different ways, trying to recreate sort of the village in an urban context, village in a positive sense, not a negative sense, but a village where people help one another, understand one another, and know one another. They know their kids, you know, and where parenting is not just a sole process between an individual's parent and their child, but it's also shared. I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, it wasn't unusual for me to hear someone yell out the window, "Hey, Mikey, go, you know, cut that out or I'll tell your mom." That is social control in action. And when you have people who can express that with respect and dignity and who are you know, respected by the kids particularly, they respond to it. Okay, but we don't have those relationships oftentimes. And so part of building social capital, or not social capital, social controls and in neighborhoods is, and collective advocacy, quite frankly, is to get people to know one another and to spend time with one another and begin to understand and respect each other. So the stages that you see in neighborhood deterioration go something like this. This is what happens in neighborhoods that is sort of are on decline. First of all, there's an inability to improve or protect the neighborhood, and that is people feel sort of helpless. They can see it coming, but they can't get away from it. They can't move. There's not much they can do about it. Then there's deterioration in the property and the property values that are there. Those people who have the resources do leave, and they leave their property probably as rental properties, which then further deteriorates and erodes the property values, which then gets linked back into schools because we use property taxes to pay for schools. Then there's segregation, the increased segregation by race, ethnicity, and class, because, and that's increasingly impoverished segregation. Then you got capital disinvestment, which means that businesses that were there leave. Then you got increased poverty and street crime, because there's not a lot of other options that are there, and it begins to rise up. And when you think of street criminals, they can't live just anywhere. They have to find a particular neighborhood where their lifestyle can be accommodated in the sense that they can find a place that they can crash that's probably day-to-day or week-to-week. They can find places where they are not necessarily going to get reported to the police by walking down the street or, you know, doing something that's odd. And so what you end up with is you have to understand that for street criminals that are into it as a lifestyle, the impoverished neighborhood is like a street lamp to an insect flying around at night. Very attractive. And that's where they can live, and that's why they end up living there. It's also where they can afford to live. And then for those people who are in the neighborhood, there's a greater sense of hopelessness and helplessness, and then a greater acceptance of the code of the streets. And the code of the streets may be oppositional and totally apart from the values and principles that are in the household, and they take hold immediately when somebody closes the door and leaves and goes out into the street. And if they violate the rules or the codes of the street, they could be living by their own ethical principles and moral principles, but if they violate the codes of the street, they could be dead. So the criminology of place matters a whole lot. And what you got to understand is where you are born and grow up and live affects your life chances throughout your whole life. It's just simply an accident of birth, and it can be a conveyor belt both to prison or college. Those people who grew up in good neighborhoods are more likely to go to college than prison. Those people who grow up in very bad neighborhoods have a much higher odds of going to prison than going to college. In a high-crime neighborhood, you see many things that are not easily accessible, you know, opportunities for jobs, employment, grocery stores, medical clinics, schools, businesses, banks, just simply not there. And here are some slides that are grocery stores in a high-crime neighborhood, in four high-crime neighborhoods in San Antonio, all next to public housing projects. Every single one of these has an open-air drug market nearby. And then if you look at these stores, you know that the people who are buying things in those stores are getting the short end of the deal in terms of price and quality. And most of those stores make their money mostly on cigarettes and beer. When you look at these high crime neighborhoods, you see many, many layers of disadvantage piled up into the same spaces. You got food scarcity, concentrated poverty, lowest education, youngest parents, most kids. It goes on and on and on and on. And these are the results of structural decisions in our society that have impacts at the street level. And if you look at the high crime areas, you can see generational change and demographic change going on. These neighborhoods that I know of that are 100 years in terms of violence, whole ethnic groups, whole racial groups have come and gone. The violence and crime has stayed because the adverse social conditions and economic conditions in those areas have remained unchanged. So here's a couple of shots that I took a few years ago. I caught these young boys coming down from an apartment on the second floor on the left-hand side, and they were probably four or five. And then I saw them looking intently to their left, and I turned the camera, and I caught this young kid who's probably 15, and he's wearing whites and blacks, which is colors that are associated with a youth gang here in San Antonio. So my questions are, what do we want for these kids 4 and 5, and what do we want for these kids 14 and 15. And I come to the conclusion that what we want for those kids, whether they're 14 or 15 or 4 and 5, we want the same things that we want for our own kids. But this neighborhood is not working with those families. It's working against them. And the odds are that those kids are going to come into confrontation with the law and violations of law and will probably have a criminal history, as often happens in these neighborhoods. So in Lincoln Courts, we started with some questions to residents. We got started getting them together, first with food and a barbecue, and we got them together in circles, and we asked questions like, first of all, what's good about the area? And you see that they respond to things like they're close to their family and friends, they're close to the schools, they're close to public health services, they're close to the food pantry, which is pretty important. They're close to their jobs. Their family history is here in this neighborhood. They look after one another. They share resources because they have to. And they feel safer than in some other places. And I look at these neighborhoods, and I know that they're not safe. And if they're safer there than they were in other places, it makes me wonder where they were living. And then they say it's affordable. And then what are your concerns? Well, there's gangs, and there's street drug use and sales. There's crime out in the streets, and there's crazy drivers that drive through the streets, and we have a poor quality of life. It's unsafe. The kids have to play inside. They can't play outside very often. Parents don't supervise their kids as much as I would like. There's disrespect and distrust among people. There's public safety issues, such as the police don't always respond when we call. There's inappropriate conduct by the police toward us. And there's broken streetlights that don't get repaired, often shot out. Then when we worked with them for several months, we began to look at sort of what would they envision. If they had the power to change their community, what would it look like? And so starting with the brown area, peaceful community, they look for friendly people, know one another, help one another. You know, the adults are respectful to other adults and to other people. Second, on the purple line, it says more security for residents, and they look at that in terms of what would they want to be more secure there, such as making sure that the lights get fixed and that there's responsible driving and that there are perhaps some speed bumps that are there. The next one says pride in community, and that is getting it cleaned up and maintained, getting it viewed positively instead of negatively. You live where? On the gold line, it's the educated. They wanted to have educated residents in the sense of how to be heard. They feel like they can't be heard, and so they want some training and some information about how to get their ideas heard and treated credibly by other people, and particularly people in decision making. Then they talk about how they want to work to keep their kids safe because they're worried about their kids in this neighborhood, and they have a right to be worried and a reason to be worried. They talk about more opportunities for constructive things with playgrounds and jobs and things for adults to work with. They also lived with the San Antonio Housing Authority, and they felt that the Housing Authority treated them very badly and oppositionally, and they felt like they were being treated with disrespect by the Housing Authority that they relied on to provide housing. And they wanted to get a cooperative relationship with the Frank Garrett Center, which is just across the street, and has recreational programs for kids, and they couldn't get access to them because the Frank Garrett Center discriminated against residents in the public housing. And they also wanted to get a public laundry facility that they could work with. So it gives you a sense that there's a pretty sophisticated understanding in the neighborhood about what would they want to see. When they set their priorities, they focused on their kids as one of their first priorities. They wanted to educate the residents as a second priority. They wanted to create more opportunities as a third priority, and then they wanted to get a laundromat, okay? What they decided to start on was the laundromat, and we worked with them for a while. They developed a very consistent plan, very, very thought-out plan. Look at the plan. They were going to petition Saha. They had a chain $5 per family as a contribution. They wanted no coin-operated machines, no vending machines. They wanted an electronic card loaded and debited by the machine so that nobody would steal coins or destroy the facility. They wanted to have a partnership with the Housing Authority to install the machines and that they would guarantee their maintenance and things like that. And so they began to work on this proposal, and they presented it to Saha. And Saha didn't understand the opportunity that they had. And Saha, after these people worked for months to do this, Saha couldn't find it in their toolbox to say yes, and we'll help you. Instead, they said no. Now, this was a huge missed opportunity for demonstrating collective efficacy and social capital and helping that neighborhood. But had they said yes, it would have changed the dynamics tremendously. Now, the upside is that those circles have continued, and they have done a lot of things since then. In the 10 years, well, actually 8 years since then, they've done a lot of things since then, and they have been very, very effective. So community leaders really need to grasp that this is a change in their role. They're going to have to be collaborative, supportive, and facilitative, not directive, not controlling, and not dominating. Now, that's a hard ask for traditional justice systems and traditional systems in our society that think of themselves as owning and controlling the problem, and we're going to solve it for you, or we're going to do things to you as opposed to with you. So restorative justice, then, and community justice, there's two sides of the same coin. They just approach the problem of healing harm differently. Restorative justice is addressing harm between people and groups of people, whereas community justice is addressing quality of life issues that harm the communities and the people that live there. And if we're going to have safe, just, equitable, and sustainable communities, we require both community justice and restorative justice, and that is the way that we find peace and build community. As Dr. Martin Luther King said, the hope of a secure and livable world lies with disciplined nonconformists who are dedicated to justice, peace, and brotherhood. I hope that's each of you. Because, and this is what the association is about, really. It's about doing this and about providing a support system for people so that they can realize Martin Luther King's dream. So we ended up 2 minutes over time, and I want to thank you for your time and attention. It's been a pleasure working with you today.
Thank you, Dr. Michael Gilbert, Executive Director of the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice. And for those who might be able to stay, Dr. Gilbert, do you have a moment to respond to one more comment slash question?
Yeah, I can take a question or two if we are there.
That would be great. Thank you. I really appreciate what we've been getting in. And Mary brings up something I think really important as far as the discussion today. Thank you, Mary, for the way that you framed this. She says, as a student of Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, a must read, of course, and that's my comment. I've learned that our criminal legal system has, in one sense, worked very well as a perpetrator of racism. So I appreciate phrases you have used like social control. My question is, do you see restorative practices as being part of how we undo white dominance and end racism? And then she adds, by the way, in my question, I mean social control is something the oppressor or dominant group does, not as something that the community does within the village. I think that there should be different terms for the two kinds of control or order.
Well, thank you for that question. That's a very, very good question. They all have been really very good questions. Yes, Michelle Alexander is probably one of my – I have a signed copy of her book, and I have – been using that book in my classes for several years since it came out. It's been a required reading for several of my classes because I think she puts her finger right directly on so much of the underlying structural and issues that we face. They're rooted in racism, and the justice system has, as you quite rightly point out, has been successful in only one thing that I can think of, and that is incarcerating lots of people and perpetuating the harm that is associated with the ways we have conceptualized what crime is, and it's almost always rooted in race, ethnicity, or class. And so yes, is restorative justice perhaps a way of responding to that in a sort of curative sense or corrective sense? I think it is, because if you really get into these ideas, it really makes you aware of the harm, the level of harm that has been perpetuated in our society and sustained in our society through racism, but also through the structural inequalities that are just simply baked into the cake. And if you go onto our website, the NACRJ website, you will probably go find on our homepage, we have a new statement on historical harm. And we're defining what historical harm is. We're calling it out. We're pointing it out to in a way that says not only do we understand what it is and its impacts, but it also calls on us to do something. And so we have framed it in a way that says that as an association, we're going to attempt to do things in our own way that will help to ameliorate the harms as we go forward in the future. Okay, so that's an example of how restorative practices is informing this historical harm of endemic racism in our society. And I think it does provide us an opportunity to talk about it. And what we do know is that harm is addressed, best addressed when it is discussed honestly, openly, non-defensively, and we strive to own up to what has been done, but we also strive to find ways to overcome it and to change the future so that we don't perpetuate these kinds of harms. Our way of addressing that is to call it out and to be very clear about where we stand. We're in the process of developing a second positioning statement on dehumanization in our community, in our society. And so we're trying to put on the record our values and principles in a very tangible way that says this is how we understand the problem and this is what we would like to try to do to work toward a better society. I hope that helps.
And again, thank you so much, Mary, for that very important comment and question. And if I may add, during the Connection Series, we are lucky enough to have Dr. Tayasha Bankhead and Tyrese Sherrill from Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth as one of our guides in small group mentoring sessions. And she noted that they are convening racial harm and historical trauma circles, including one coming up in their area in the Bay Area. So she's been doing some incredible work, as has Dr. Fania Davis, in that regard.
Tayasha Bankhead is on our board of directors, and Fania Davis was one of the co-founders.
That's right. So just want to thank you, Mike, for all your work, tireless, selfless work that you do with the National Association, and for your time today in sharing such a poignant presentation and your insights and body of work over 5 decades.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
And we'll be looking forward to just hearing more from you and, of course, seeing you in June at the Denver Conference. And again, everyone, thank you for your participation in the Connection Series. On behalf of Restorative Justice on the Rise, this is Molly Rowan-Leach, your host, and we want to again acknowledge and thank the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice. Thank you, everyone.